Welcome to DCEKG, where we diagnose Washington's policy issues and prescribe needed solutions. Here's your hosts, Joe Grogan and Eric Ulan.
Welcome back to DCEKG, where we diagnose DC's policy diseases and prescribe needed solutions. I'm Joe Grogan, and joining me as always is Eric Ulan. Today, we're delighted to welcome Judy Stecker to the podcast. Judy is a senior vice president at Hill & Knowlton, where she works with clients within the pharmaceutical sector primarily, but she's also had a remarkable journey in government where she served most recently as assistant secretary for public affairs and as deputy chief of staff at the Department of Health and Human Services. This is a very special episode because our sponsor is Survivors for Solutions, which was started by our producer, John Swartacki. And both Eric and I and Swartacki are very committed to pharmaceutical innovation and getting policy right so that today's patients and the patients of tomorrow can have hope and find cures and better treatments than exist today. So Judy, thank you so much for joining. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
So a few weeks ago, picked up the paper and saw what was an absolutely beautiful op-ed that you wrote about your son and what he faces from a medical perspective and your frustrations with the Food and Drug Administration, some of the standards. Maybe you could start with your own story here and your journey with your son and why these issues are so important to you.
Well, again, thanks for having me. And it's so nice to kind of see your faces again, a blast from the not so distant past. But I actually, wrote the piece for the journal, and I had written a piece last year in STAT about FDA and what they were doing at the time when there was a drug getting ready to go into phase 3 clinical trials. And sadly, between that time and now, in 12 months, the overregulation and the bureaucracy killed basically that trial. That trial is being paused right now because of a need for more funds, given what barriers the FDA has created. But rewinding from there, just my story, we served together in the previous administration, and 4 months in, I found out to my surprise that I was pregnant. I had been told that wouldn't be possible for us. We had had some fertility struggles, a number of miscarriages. And that's how actually my husband and I found out we were both carriers of a rare genetic disease, CLN3 juvenile Batten disease. And so, we determined that we were not going to test in utero because we're pro-life, so we wouldn't have terminated the pregnancy. And we, did a lot of prayer and decided that when Wheeler was born, we would have him tested. And so we found out 4 weeks later that he was affected, that he had got both bad genes. And I think after my first call was to Secretary Azar at the time, and I think my second call was with Francis Collins, who was explaining to me, what was happening with my son's genetics and what it would entail, and that there was a natural history study happening at the NIH. And so Wheeler, to our knowledge, is the youngest to ever be diagnosed with the disease. And he's been followed by the NIH since he was 5 weeks old. So that, he truly can help contribute to the science, and we can learn more about what this disease does and when. For your listeners, most children with CLN3, which is a particular type of Batten disease, are diagnosed usually around 5 or 6 years old when they have complete vision loss. There are behavior issues that happen before that, but for the most part, pediatricians reasonably assume that it might be autism, sensory processing disorder, ADHD, things that are much more common than an ultra-rare genetic disease that impacts only, I think, really there is 32 kids in the United States. There are about 5,000 children globally that have all types of NCL diseases. And so when you think about that in a population of 7 billion, it is an ultra, ultra rare condition. But, you know, he is so unique because it's not until that complete vision loss that doctors begin to wonder what else might be there. So Wheeler turns 5 this May. So thankfully, we have not seen yet some of those more dramatic impacts of the disease, but we do see the behavioral issues, and he does have some global delays. And we do know, because he's participated in that NIH natural history, at 3 years old, we began to see the deterioration of his retina and the thinning of the retina. So we just, you know, continue to pray and work tirelessly to try and help him have a Batten story that is very different than any of the children that have gone before him.
So when you, so you're at HHS at the time you discover this, but you became an activist when you left the administration. Is that a fair statement? And began to get more involved in advocacy around children like your son. Can you talk a little bit about that, about your advocacy work, and how, it allows you to advocate for your son and what your goals are from an advocacy perspective?
Yeah, correct. So while I was serving, there was no, you know, obviously, because that wouldn't be appropriate. You know, Wheeler had just been diagnosed and we weren't seeing any impacts, right? We got him enrolled in the natural history study, which, and I did not accept any funds. A lot of times when families participate in clinical trials, they have transportation or other things reimbursed. We had none of that to make sure that there were no ethical issues. So he began to participate in that. And it wasn't until after the administration had ended that I really had the opportunity to kind of work more with different organizations, talk to other parents, sort of build that network and use my understanding of just the labyrinth that is, you know, FDA's bureaucracy to try and help other families figure out what might be out there and get them, you know, I think we've gotten a number of other families interested and enrolled in the NIH natural history study because people just don't know where to look. You know, you get this horrific diagnosis and you have no idea what to do next. And so, you know, trying to help other families while also navigating our own terrain. And I will say, you know, I had an advantage because to a certain extent, because I just even knew what to Google, right? I knew where to look. I knew that such programs existed, which I don't think I would have ever known had I not been fortunate enough to be where I was. You know, what's been most painful is that when Wheeler was initially diagnosed, there were 3 potential therapeutics in the pipeline. And now there are, for all intents and purposes, none. And that's happened for a variety of reasons, but it's just, you know, really unfortunate that hope in such a short period of time can disappear before your very eyes. You know, and I've just found that because I have the knowledge base that I do. And I also have a background in communications. I was doing media relations long before I joined the administration. I have the ability to use my voice in a way that a lot of other families don't. And I think that I can come at it from a particular perspective because I can understand and I can sort of counter some of the talking points that you might hear from an agency, you know, oh, well, this is, we have to be concerned about safety, or, you know, there's this particular rule or law or piece of, you know, legislation or bureaucratic standing that we can't, you know, do anything about. And if I'm a, you know, a parent that just hasn't been in the trenches of this, I'm going to say, oh, okay, I guess that's right. That's, you know, I'll just go back to, you know, fighting with my insurance company and trying to do the best I can for my child. Whereas I can say, no, I know where that statute is, or I know how that rule came to be, or I can look in the Federal Register. So I can kind of pull at that thread more than others. And I think that's where I've managed to find where I can be helpful in this space, because I'm certainly not, you know, a scientist or a major fundraiser as some other parents have been that have managed to get drugs to a point where a pharmaceutical company is interested in them. That's just not where my contributions lie. So I think, you know, I've just been hyper focused on how can I bring attention to this issue and how can I foster a constructive policy conversation so that we can change some of the places that can there where change can make a difference, right? The science can't be helped. You know, my son's particular disease is a transmembrane protein that is incredibly difficult, and we don't necessarily understand what it is that it does. But we know that when it doesn't work the way it's supposed to, every cell in his body fills up with trash, right? He's missing his garbage man. And so what happens is the cells fill up with garbage and they die. And some cells your body makes more of, like skin cells, but your body doesn't make more brain cells and it doesn't make more eye cells. So when those cells are dead, you're done. And that can't be helped. That science is going to be hard, and that's going to require a lot of funds and research and bright and dedicated people. But what can be helped are the bureaucratic hurdles that are put into place that make it all the more challenging for a challenging science to move forward and to take that from lab to jab, right? And that can be helped, and that's somewhere where I think I can foster that conversation and dialogue. And so that's really where I've chosen to focus my efforts. And I'm hoping that it leads to a productive conversation, although it didn't 12 months ago, which is why I had to write again. So hopefully we'll have better luck this time.
So Judy, absolutely. Both your piece in the journal and the earlier piece in the stat, as well as just this focus on FDA and the challenges it creates for parents like yourself. You mentioned that when this began, there were three drugs in process that might have been helpful, and at the moment, there are none. Could you unpack that a little bit? And in particular, given your experiences, what FDA has done to create the impediments, the barriers to actually getting over the hump of getting these drugs from exploration to actually utilization?
Yeah. So one of the drugs was being explored by Polarix, and I can't speak to what happened there. It still is on clinicaltrials.gov, but nothing has come of it in multiple years. The two I can speak to a little more was, and I wrote about them in the journal piece, was Amicus was exploring a gene therapy that had initially started at Nationwide Children's in Columbus, Ohio. And so I think about six kids have been dosed with that gene therapy, and they'll continue to follow those children. But bringing it to a wider audience was proving difficult. And I think part of the problem was certainly when the pandemic happened, it was much more difficult to get an AAV9 vector. A lot of things got put on hold or shelved. I think the other thing was that the initial investigational new drug for that gene therapy came through the process of research and academic institution. And then when it was moving to a pharmaceutical company, taking that on and bringing it to the next level, there were FDA policies and bureaucracies that then needed to happen to move that from one sort of IND to another. And there were barriers to doing that, things that needed to be repeated that couldn't because they didn't have enough of the vector anymore, or they didn't have enough of other things. And again, it was just regulatory barriers, that flexibility wasn't applied to be able to help take something that had begun from a more research and academic standard moving into now a pharmaceutical exploration. So that was the bulk of that problem, as well as just, you know, the costs involved in doing this kind of research. And I will say, of any pharmaceutical company, you know, Amicus has really demonstrated that their commitment to these kinds of patients. John Crowley, their founder, has two children with a rare disease. So I know from a patient advocacy point of view and from other patient groups, you know, we were certainly disappointed, but we knew that it wasn't primarily a bottom line issue, because we knew that company and the founder were so committed that if they could find a way to do it, they would. And I think that the barriers were just so great that they couldn't do that. So they've returned the rights of that to Children's Nationwide. And we, by all indications, we've heard that they're going to kind of try to continue pursuing that. But we just, you know, only time will tell what happens. And it's a challenge for an academic institution to bring that to a greater patient population. The one I'm most familiar with is obviously the one that's being put forth by Beyond Batten Disease Foundation, which, you know, my family supports. They're the only Batten Disease Foundation dedicated specifically to CLN3. And they've done a tremendous amount of work looking at miglustat, which is an existing drug used in Gaucher disease and has been approved in the United States for over 20 years. And it's a small molecule. And it's also been used off-label in Niemann-Pick type C, and they've been fighting for it to get an approval from the FDA for their indication. And they have gobs of data that has shown that it helps patients retain their swallow function and other things. And for some reason, the FDA just, you know, has not moved forward on that. So they've really struggled with that as well. But Beyond Batten Disease did a number of years, decades of research on miglustat and what its implications might be when it comes to CLN3, and finally got it to a place where they could get a pharmaceutical company interested. So now they've partnered with Theranexus. And Beyond Batten Disease is the one that holds the IND. They've just had to work with Theranexus, because these small family foundations, which many of them are trying to bring therapeutics in rare disease, just aren't equipped, right, for those next steps. They're not equipped to be able to navigate the labyrinth that is FDA and then meet the requirements of what's necessary to do these clinical trials. You know, we do bake sales and golf tournaments and, you know, mini campaigns to try and raise money for the research. But, you know, we are not sort of the experts to then get it through. So it really requires partnering with a pharmaceutical company to get it to that level. So Batten-1, as it's called, is the drug, and its primary component is miglustat. And it's the phase one trial was done with the capsule, which you can get and is manufactured. And what Theranexus and Beyond Batten are trying to do is an oral formulation for pediatrics, so that it can be titrated more appropriately. And a lot of kids, you know, can't take capsules. And so that phase 1-2 trial was done in children over 17. So not technically, maybe not pediatrics, but done in children over 17, where the disease has progressed a good amount. And so that was being done just from a safety component, and it's demonstrated safety, which I don't think anybody thought was going to be difficult to prove given the safety profile. And it's been showing some signs of efficacy in the various milestone reports that we've seen. There's been a decrease of neurofilaments in the cerebrospinal fluid, and a neurofilament is a byproduct of neural cell death. So seeing less could then imply that less neural cell death was happening. They also have seen that those children have maintained mobility compared to natural history data that we have. So in going to the phase 3 trial, which we were all expecting to start at the beginning of this year, we were surprised when we heard from Theranexus that in order to, they had to put this out as is customary during the early year of what their financial outlook was, and that more funds would be needed in order to do that phase three trial. There was then a research call with families, which told us why. You know, last year I wrote my op-ed because I was really up in arms about the fact that the FDA was requiring a placebo and what that would do in terms of recruitment for that trial, and why not only did I didn't feel like it was necessary, given there's 22 years of natural history data on CLN3, both at the NIH and the University of Rochester Batten Center, but that I think it's unethical when you know that a child will lose their vision, lose their mobility, lose their ability to eat, engage, have childhood dementia, and be unable to make new memories and therefore cannot learn. When you know that that is the progression of the disease, I believe it is unethical to do a placebo because you know what will happen without, you know, I can't say that with a drug, my son won't go blind, but I can say that without a drug, he most certainly will. And so I was hyper-focused on that. Had I known that 12 months later, there would be no trial to even argue about the use of placebo with, you know, that would have been a very different conversation. But, you know, the phase three trial is now paused because the expense of conducting it, given the barriers that FDA has required, is just astronomical. So, for example, placebo, right? When you require a placebo, you need to expand the number of potential patients you can recruit because you know that there's going to be a certain amount of people that won't participate because they don't want placebo. There were other things like endpoints, right? So FDA establishes endpoints in order to determine efficacy of a drug. One of their primary endpoints was vision. Well, 90% of children with CLN3 are blind by the time they have a diagnosis. And this isn't just applicable to CLN3, right? This is many rare diseases. It takes anywhere between 5 to 9 years to get a rare disease diagnosis. And so by that time, children are far too progressed to be able to meet the endpoints that FDA is establishing for efficacy. Like, how do you judge that a drug is working based on vision when children don't even know they have this disease until they're completely blind? Like, this is just sort of like basics. So then,
Judy,
I'll take a breath.
So take that example here. When you and others sit and explain and try to work with FDA to get the aperture right, and in this case, trial easily and much to your point, much earlier, what's the reaction as you kind of put some of this common sense in front of them, and yet they're rebuffing this?
Yeah. So I want to clarify that because I'm not the drug developer or the sponsor, I haven't been in any of those direct conversations.
Fair point.
But when I have talked to folks at FDA, including some of their chief medical officer, people in their various departments, and this falls under CDER and the rare disease, it's sort of like, well, we can't speak to that particular drug. And I said, fine, even if we're not talking about this particular drug, like when you're establishing an endpoint that is unmeetable, what do you do? Well, we consider other endpoints. You know, they may not be the primary endpoint, but there are other things that we consider, you know. And so and I've heard this from other families, like they'll go to ADCOMs, right, where they're talking about a particular drug. They'll be showing video of children taking it off label who couldn't walk and are now walking. And you just have scientists looking at it saying, well, I see that, but it's not scientifically significant enough in the data that we're pulling. And it's just, you know, FDA has talked a lot about different programs and initiatives they're doing to encourage and increase patient participation in the design of clinical trials and these, but it's just not translating into kids getting treated. And I don't want to think that it's just lip service. I really do think that there are a lot of committed people at the FDA. I just think that they've become too big and too bureaucratic and too, you know, focused on the process versus the goals to be able to take those things into consideration and weigh them more heavily than just numbers on a piece of paper. And I think we really need to change the culture and the how they go about doing these things, right? Because just gathering a bunch of us in a room and listening to us and then going back into your office and doing things the same way you've always done them is not achieving the goal.
Right. Right. Well, let's talk about that for a little bit, you know, because you have obviously the personal experience with this, butting up against the bureaucracy, but you're also a policy expert, right? You've seen these policies implemented at HHS, you've had to sell them to the media, to skeptical audiences, to other experts. And now, when I spent 2 years at the FDA, I mean, one expression you have drilled into your head is, with sort of gallows humor, is nobody was ever fired for not approving a drug, right? There is this, the agency gets criticized for approving a drug when there's a side effect down the road that they didn't anticipate, didn't know about. And there are many examples of drugs that, quote unquote, blew up because of side effects that occurred down the road. You know, Celebrex, Vioxx were taken off the market. I personally think they were great drugs. You know, there was a lot of criticism. I think that had that happened a few years later, maybe they would have still been on the market, you know, with different labeling perhaps, but Celebrex was a drug I certainly like. But in the case of rare diseases, what's so fascinating to me is it really drills down into the conundrum of human beings implementing rigid policies and the machinations of the guts of a bureaucracy. So one, you mentioned the placebo and the difficulty and expense and why some people wouldn't want to take a placebo. Well, also it's a rare disease. There aren't a gazillion people out there looking to that you can find to participate in a trial. They may be far away from a clinical center, from a hospital that would be able to do this. I mean, it's just mind-boggling that they wouldn't be more flexible in finding the natural history, using the natural history progression.
You hit the nail on the head. So that was the other thing, like between the placebo, the endpoints, like kind of what really stalled this phase three was also the numbers. So initially, it was like 30-something kids. And again, you know, I haven't been part of the conversations. I know what I know as a parent who's been just, you know, what the research conversations have been with different parents. But, you know, our understanding was that it was going to be a couple of sites in the U.S. and potentially a few sites in the United Kingdom or Europe. When the FDA then required much greater numbers of patient participants, it had to become a global clinical trial. This is a family foundation. This is not a giant pharmaceutical company. So the mechanics and money and just ability to run a global clinical trial, that like you have to go global to get 60 right. kids with Batten.
Right.
This is craziness. And so that was what really kind of ended it. Not ended it, but that's what's made this stall. Right. Like we don't have the money to go from what we perceived we needed to do. And I think that's the other frustration too, is that the goalposts were changed, right?
Right.
You know, initial conversations were happening with an area of FDA that deals with metabolic diseases. And then all of a sudden they were put into a different department. And it should not be luck of the draw of what department is reviewing your potential therapeutic to determine whether or not you can proceed. Like
right.
that to is. Me is
right. Because it's a different group of human beings with a different history, different experiences, different core competencies. And so they view it, they just view it differently. And you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, because you mentioned, oh, it's not statistically significant on the natural history examples that you showed. You've got a really small population set that you've just halved with the placebo group. And now you're going overseas, and FDA is very skeptical of data gathered overseas. Now, in some, they've gotten better about certain countries with first-rate medical systems, but they don't like the different practice of medicine. They don't like other drugs. They sometimes don't like the record-keeping. All these issues confound the ability to run a cost-effective clinical trial. And it's just so frustrating to think, had those things been laid out before, nobody would even attempted this, right? The goalposts were moved and everybody's like, we're done, you know, and all this money's been invested, all these patients are given hope, and the rug's taken out from under you just sort of randomly out of your own control. So it's just such a frustrating example. The other thing I wanted to press on you a little bit is, you know, Tom Phillipson's written about this too, the warp speed example, which you lived through, all the way till the end, right? So you watched the FDA change on a dime. I mean, I was in the cabinet room when Tony Fauci said it's going to take us 5 years, maybe 8 years before we get a vaccine. The president and a lot of other people said that's unacceptable. Companies came in. The FDA changed its standards to get those vaccines approved. The same level of urgency applied to rare diseases could really move the ball for patients and for innovation, lowering costs, getting more companies interested, more researchers, more human beings on the innovation side involved in it. How do you think, having lived through warp speed, what would you suggest FDA do in applying those lessons to rare diseases?
Yeah. I think, you know, and I just wanted to make a quick point that you made on like just the complexities of a global trial. I think when those goalposts change, if you're just a regular pharma company, you know, you have to kind of cut your losses and move on. And I don't blame those companies for that. You know, there have been more than 200 rare disease therapies shelved as a result. And I thank God that beyond, like, there's a family foundation of Beyond Batten Disease that is continuing to press forward to make the phase three trial happen. And so while, you know, these challenges have come up, if it was just, you know, a run of the mill pharma, I would completely understand not pursuing. But again, you have this family foundation that's really committed to patients that is going to find a way to make this happen. But again, we shouldn't have had to get to this point, right? Because they did fundraise. They had budgeted for what the phase three would cost. And when those changes happened and cost changed, you know, there was thought that had gone into that. And I really applaud them for their continued pursuit I applaud Theranexus too, because they're still trying to make it happen. And I hope against all hope that they're able to fundraise that money to do that. To the warp speed point, again, yeah, we saw what FDA can do when they put their minds to it, right? And, you know, I think a big part of that were the people that we were working with, right? Obviously, you know, your team at the White House, Secretary Azar, and our team at HHS, and, you know, a long-time career civil servant, Peter Marks. I mean, Peter is willing to take risks. And, you know, I think there were a lot of memos that came out afterwards through Freedom of Information where Peter was being attacked by some on his own staff, right? There were people who resigned in protest because of the speed with which things were happening. But things were happening quickly because FDA was working hand in hand with partners and manufacturers so that when a problem was happening at a manufacturing plant that they could go to FDA and they would have an answer by 5 o'clock. Not the traditional way of we have a problem. We present it to FDA, and then in 60 to 90 days, somebody gets back to us. Like, there was this, you know, instantaneous feedback loop. There was obviously the commitment to solving this problem. And really, there was the intestinal fortitude of the people that were working on it and being willing to say, you know, this is important and we need to press forward and we can't do things the way that we've always done them because we don't have the time. And there's no reason FDA can't do that when it comes to rare disease. And I do think I know Peter is trying to do that in the Center for Biologics. He's, you know, created a warp speed for rare disease, and he's working on things when it comes to gene editing and other things, and really demonstrating that FDA can be both a ref and a coach, right? You can help somebody do the things that are necessary to do to get to the outcome they want without letting them cheat. And I think we learned that with Warp Speed. And I think we're seeing Peter do that with biologics in the rare disease space. I mean, there are children with DMD who are walking because he overruled his own staff to get it approved. That is just crazy to me. And I'm just grateful that there are Peters at FDA. There needs to be more Peters at FDA. Right. That's the problem. And so gene therapy and biologics are great, but small molecules are going to be what helps buy patients time for those therapies to come about. And it's just that you are in the same agency and just see completely different points of view and ways of going about things from CBER to CDER, that it's just mind-boggling. You can't believe that they work at the same department. And so to your point, Joe, like what are lessons to be learned? Like, why don't we standardize how FDA does accelerated approvals? Or why can't we, you know, I talked about this a bit in my journal piece. Why can't we make expanded access do things a little differently? Why can't we weight natural history data more heavily for rare diseases than we do for other things? You know, everyone's like, well, we can't have a different standard for everything. And I understand that. But you also can't use a standard of judging apples when you've got kiwis. And you have to recognize that. And they just don't.
That is a great point. Yeah.
They continue to treat everything as if it's an apple, and that's just not functional. And so with Warp Speed, we saw an EUA level standard, right? If it has the potential to do more good than harm, right, then it should receive approval. And let's, you know, that's similar to sort of accelerated approval, but it's again been very uneven and luck of the draw of how that happens. And if FDA could make that clearer and more standardized, that would signal to, I think, the industry things that they could do and then result in more research and development. Because right now, it's a crapshoot.
So, Judy, some listeners might, hearing this story and the terrible challenges that FDA has created for you and others in similar situation, might think about the right to try law, which was passed several years ago and seems to open the door in certain circumstances to people having access to drugs well before an approval stage. Walk through whether or not that actually is applicable in a case like this, and if not, what the real challenges are here.
Yeah. I was really proud. You know, I was at HHS during Right to Try, and I know you all were in the administration, and that was a very proud day, I think, for all of us. And, you know, Right to Try, compassionate use, these are all great things, but there are challenges with them, right? You know, a drug company doesn't necessarily have to provide the drug. And in the case of Wheeler particularly, again, it's a small family foundation that has established it. So they don't have the drug to give, right? So, you know, there's that. But the other challenge with Right to Try is sort of, it is wonderful for an individual, but it's sort of a Hail Mary for one particular person. Although some will argue compassionate use can be done for broader swaths. But the bigger problem is that none of that data, none of what you might see the value of that therapy is then considered by the FDA for approval. And so it's not scalable, right? So, you know, it's a great thing, but if let's say, the stars all aligned and we were able to get access to that drug and it turned out to really be a game changer, my son would be the only one to benefit. And frankly, this is about more than just my son. This is about an entire swath of patients who just are desperately hoping and needing options. And, you know, as a result, we're willing to take greater risk and we're willing to try new things, but we want it to be for the betterment of all of those patients and not just our children. And again, that's why I'm really grateful for these family foundations, because many of these foundations, not just in Batten, but Pompe disease, Neem and Pick, like all sorts of other rare diseases, you know, a lot of people who have founded those foundations and are continuing to raise money, their children are long gone and they're doing it for other kids. And it's only because those families have that commitment that families like mine are even able to kind of explore these options. So I really applaud them. But that's why we need something greater.
So when you were at HHS, did you have any sort of visibility on this entire really energetic ecosystem, finding rare diseases and really trying to drive FDA and other health policy officials to pay attention, innovate cures, and do what was necessary on the regulatory side to get out of the way and accelerate development and ultimately deployment? Or was this all new to you after Wheeler's birth and his diagnosis?
It was all new to me. Really? I mean, I joined the administration as the Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs. So I did a lot basically on communication. So I understood some of the policies, but I was not anywhere near understanding just sort of the hurdles and the labyrinth that existed. And again, you know, some of that is necessary, right? I am not advocating, nor would anyone ever want to see, you know, another thalidomide. You know, nor am I saying that I want snake oil salesmen either, but there can be a balance between safety and efficacy. And that doesn't mean that you have to regulate every molecule and every little thing from A to Z, which is what is the current process. And I don't think that's, you know, I think that's something that needs flexibility for rare disease, but I don't necessarily believe that level of regulatory scrutiny is necessary across the board, right? So I think, you know, we can maintain the highest levels and the gold standard of safety. But there's some flexibility we can have when it comes to efficacy, especially for rare disease, right? Because you are getting kids who are further progressed by the time a clinical trial happens, you can't accurately gauge efficacy. Like FDA has to do things by the rules. And they raise that a lot of times, that there are rules in the Food and Drug Cosmetic Act that they have to adhere to. They have an incredible amount of flexibility when it comes to how to interpret that. And I think that they need to use that flexibility when it comes to rare disease, and they need to signal to the ecosystem how they plan to use that flexibility.
So well before it comes to whether or not there need to be changes in law or changes in how resources flow, there needs to be a change in attitude based on your experience and what you're seeing with these other groups of parents and people
And if FDA can't exercise that flexibility, then maybe we do need to get laws, which is what needed to happen with Right to Try, right? If there needs to be a law to push FDA to use the flexibility that it has. But it has a wide breadth of how it interprets, how it executes on that. And I think that they need to use that flexibility when it comes to rare disease, and there's no reason it can't, other than, you know, I don't know if the spirit is willing but the flesh is weak. I really don't know, because I've seen them exercise that flexibility before. I mean, with children with end-stage cancer, there are all kinds of things that the FDA does. Right. Why they don't do that for, you know, terminal rare disease?
Never been an explanation given.
No. I don't know.
I'll make one suggestion. I mean, they're partially people. I mean, Rick Pazder was running the oncology division, and he's different. And you mentioned Brian Marks. I mean, people matter in these decisions. We often think, oh, it's just science. It's like a equation, and you get to the end, and there's the answer. It's either, but this is really tough stuff, and there are judgment calls all the time, and you need to have the right people in these positions who have the guts to take risks and can see it from the other perspective and are flexible enough. I mean, you mentioned, you know, the need for a law, perhaps. Talk about the broader climate for a second. I mean, we've just had the Inflation Reduction Act, which has price setting in Part D. There's talks about march-in rights from NIH. And of course, every week there's somebody on Capitol Hill, sometimes daily, railing about the greed of pharmaceutical companies. Can you talk about the climate right now, and what are policymakers missing in all this?
Yeah, the anti-innovation sentiment in Washington is just, it's palpable and it's catastrophic, right? So, you know, I kind of doubled down on that FDA and talking about things that they could do, because that's somewhere in my wheelhouse, right? And agency actions can happen a lot faster than legislative. But I mean, when you're talking about an already underinvested therapy area in rare disease, which is not so rare, right? There are 7,000 some odd rare diseases. So we're not as rare as you think. And now everybody who's listening will know somebody with a rare disease, because they'll know Wheeler. So it'll hopefully be a lot more palpable to them than it might have been before. But the public policy, like the Inflation Reduction Act, right, delays launches and reduces research of uses of drugs in small or rare populations, right? And so for some folks that may not know everything about the IRA, which I don't claim to know either, but there are exceptions, right? So that if you have an orphan drug, you are excluded from the mandatory Medicare negotiation. Well, what if that drug might help another indication or another disease, like miglustat, right? We know miglustat helps with Gaucher disease. We're seeing that miglustat has efficacy in Niemann-Pick. We've seen that miglustat might be helpful in CLN3. No pharmaceutical company is going to invest research and development dollars to see what else that drug could do if it's going to then force them to have to negotiate, like Medicare is going to be able to price fix that drug. There's no incentive, right? What if I've developed a drug that I know will help a small population of rare disease, but as soon as I put it out on the market, that starts the clock for it to be negotiated with. So I'm not going to launch that drug. I'm going to wait until maybe I can figure out if that drug can serve a larger patient population before I launch it. Or I'm going to launch it somewhere else. I'm not going to launch my drugs in the United States anymore. So then there's all those patients that don't get a benefit of a potential therapeutic because, you know, they can't get access to that drug because, and I understand, like, if I'm a pharmaceutical company, you know, I think people don't get that this is an incredibly risky industry. 90% of therapies fail or don't do what they had hoped to do, or, you know, don't even get to that point. And how much money, you know, you don't recoup the costs of that. And I think we don't acknowledge how much is spent to get to the place where they get. And I think everybody just wants to say, oh, these people are greedy. And it's just like, you need to understand all of the time and energy and money that goes into getting things to that point. And that needs to be recouped. But also, drugs that serve larger populations, that money goes back into research and development for drugs that don't serve as large of a population. And so if we're truly altruistic about our healthcare, you know, maybe it's thoughtful for people to think like, you know, my medication might be a little more expensive than I'd like it to be because it's going to go to solve a problem of a disease I haven't even thought of yet. And so if we need to think about that as well. I think the other thing that is really devastating to the rare community is the march in rights. So many rare disease research happens in partnership with the federal government because you don't have interest from larger commercial corporations to look at these diseases. And so if, you know, family foundations, like I said, are the ones bringing the science to bear, they can't do that without grants from the NIH or without support from Sanford Labs in the Dakotas. And they get their money through NIH grants. And so when you're a family foundation that has done the research and the animal models, and you finally have a molecule to the point where you can get an interest of a pharmaceutical company, no pharmaceutical company is going to partner with you if they think that once they do so, that the government can march in because they contributed to the research of getting it this far. And I think it's devastating for NIH too, because this hurts public-private partnerships that were so necessary, right? Warp Speed, that was public-private partnerships. It's just so chilling to the industry. And even though people argue, oh, well, the people will get sued and this is never going to come to fruition, it still has impacts right now. And it chills innovation. It chills exploration. Is it going to change? Is it going to stop all pharmaceutical research? No. But it's going to change where those research dollars go. And kids like my son are going to be left out in the cold. And it's not because, you know, it's mean-spirited or cold-hearted pharma. It's because, you know, they have to make choices of where they're going to put those funds. And, you know, I can't blame them when something is like rare disease is so expensive and so challenging, and to know that they might not ever recoup those funds or even come at a loss, that means another rare disease won't get explored, right? It all has domino impacts. And so that's just in combination of just the already challenging labyrinth that is the regulatory environment. You add in these anti-innovation sentiments and saying you're going to expand these things. It's like, you know, and that's why I was very careful, right, to say that these were narrow-minded policies. Because I think, you know, we all recognize that, you know, drugs are expensive, you know, and President Trump and, you know, that our administration, we were focused on lowering drug prices as well, right? But how you do something is just as important as what you're trying to do. And the ends don't necessarily justify the means. And I think these particular policies were very narrow-mindedly focused on, okay, how do we just get the prices down, and or how can we use every lever at our disposal, not thinking about, you know, what's in the blast zone of doing that. And unfortunately, kids like mine are in the blast zone.
So Judy, even inside this terrible landscape, awful challenge, and to your point, a blast zone, with the expertise and your background being brought to bear, are there policymakers and ears open to the points you're making? Is there an acknowledgement, at least beginning to bleed through in some quarters, that, whoa, wait a second, this challenge in particular indicates a bigger systemic challenge with FDA and how we approach regulation in an effort, to your point, get that balance right. Are there people on Capitol Hill, are there people around the country who are paying attention in new ways, courtesy of the advocacy and the efforts that you're bringing to bear?
I think so. There's a lot of conversations happening. Some people are arguing for a new Orphan Drug Act. You know, do we need Orphan Drug 2.0? And I think that there's some merits to that. I just, you know, for my part, I do think that there are folks on Capitol Hill that are interested. And I think that there are people within FDA. I think it's just sort of like folks don't know where to start. Right. It's almost like hoarders. Like you walk in and you're like, I know this house is like filled with trash, but I don't even know where to begin to like find the floor. And so that's why I tried to offer suggestions in my piece of where people could start. But ultimately, it requires having those particular people. It's like what Joe said, you know, when we were talking about why is it this way or the other, it's people. And so I think that there's going to need to be, you know, just those dedicated public servants that are willing to take that risk, right? Because FDA does find itself very often, to be fair, in a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. And Joe, you were absolutely right when you said no one's going to get fired for not approving a drug, right? And so, you know, there's no incentive when they do something perceived too quickly, or, you know, not all the boxes were checked, you know, they're raked over the coals. And so if I'm somebody at FDA, like, why put myself through that? Why do that? And it's like, do that so that kids like my son, you know, might be able to live past 15, or have some quality of life. And I know that he's just one kid, but there are lots of kids like him. And you know, remembering that and remembering that mission is going to be critical. So I don't know what kind of culture shift will make that happen. I do think that there's people that are interested and want to do it, but I think they just don't know where to start. And so I hope that some of the things that I mentioned will be there. And I hope, you know, we get creative people in the agencies thinking about how to do that. But, you know, I do think, you know, does there need to be an Orphan Drug Act 2.0? Should there be a statute similar to emergency use authorization written? Should that be something that Congress works on so that there can be, you know, stability and guardrails and understanding of what a new sort of level that needs to be met for approval for specific types of diseases or indications? And I'll note for those who haven't, you know, aren't super familiar with the statute that establishes the emergency use authorization, it's not just FDA, right? I think CDC and NIH are a part of that conversation. So maybe that's going to be what's necessary to take some of the heat off FDA to make that happen. I don't know, but it's an idea worth exploring and would give sort of the signal to industry of what, you know, standards need to be met, and also make it so that FDA isn't the sole arbiter, right? So we'll see, but I just don't know what the appetite is there.
Well, Judy, we really appreciate the time today and your passion, intensity, and focus. The story of Wheeler is both a terrible example of an indifferent at best bureaucracy, but also really inspiring with what you and your husband have done here and everybody else in the foundation, as well as, to your point, throughout the entire community of rare diseases. So I hope we can continue to talk to you here as the years unfold. And I think we are all incredibly prayerful that FDA will ultimately find its way clear as quickly as possible to open the door and ensure that this molecule is available to your son and many other sufferers as well.
Thanks. I will also say, I think one of the big questions people said is like, what about off-label? And I did want to just take a quick moment for that. So yeah, some of these things like off-label certainly are options, but again, health insurers rely on FDA approvals to determine whether or not, you know, coverage of a drug. And we've seen that, you know, with not just commercial insurers, but CMS and others. With miglustat in particular, off-label without insurance is for the dosage that Wheeler would require to be therapeutic would be $24,000 a month. And again, people are like, well, why don't you, you know, bootleg it in from Canada? Oh, from Canada, it's $18,000. So not much of a discount, because while this is a small molecule, it's not manufactured in a great numbers because there are not a lot of people that take it. And again, it took a long time to figure out that this molecule does something. And so there needs to be costs recouped from that. So, you know, I think people want to find different areas to place the blame. And I think ultimately we need to start with, you know, just the source. And I'm not saying that necessarily FDA is the source of everything, but it costs a lot of money to do the science, and that can't be helped. But for companies to require millions upon millions of dollars in experts and lobbyists to be able to figure out how to navigate the FDA and meet all of the requirements, and then, you know, spend all that tons of money, like, that also contributes to the costs of therapies, right? Because you have to pay to get it through all of the hoops it needs to go through. And if we can make that a little more streamlined and a little easier without sacrificing safety and efficacy, then that would also decrease drug prices.
Seems pretty commonsensical to all of us. So again, thanks for your time today. And if you want to dive deeper into Judy's incredible journey in battling Batten and finding a cure, be sure to connect with her on social media at Wheeler's Warriors on Facebook, Instagram, and X, formerly known as Twitter. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Survivors for Solutions, our executive producer, John C.Z. Swartacki, our producer, Lauren Timmerman, our distribution partner, Big Wig Media, and our production team, Evergreen. On behalf of DCEKG and our host, Joe Grogan, this is Eric Euland. Thanks for listening. We'll be talking.
This has been DCEKG. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss the next episode. While you're at it, leave us a rating and review to help others find out about the show. We'll be right back.